Today on The Grave Talks, Talking with the Dead, a conversation with Tanner Rutledge. Waking up in the middle of the night to a strange woman standing in the corner. Who is she? What does she want? Why is she there? These are the questions that Tanner Rutledge asked as a child. As he grew older, he would continue to try to find answers as to what haunted him and what haunts those around us. This is his story today on The Grave Talks.
Wow. So my earliest memory is going to be back when I was in elementary school. I grew up in a house that it was an older home. It had been moved to the property where we lived. It was somewhere in the middle of town. It was moved out to a farm, and I saw things in the house that I couldn't explain. There was my parents didn't talk about it until I was older, but I would see this woman, and she was always in. It's not really a white dress, but it was kind of like maybe a nightgown. She had long, dark hair, and every once in a while, I would see her in the house, moving down the hall, standing in what was my old bedroom. And when I got older, my mom finally opened up and talked about it, and she would say that she would wake up in the middle of the night and see this woman standing over my crib. So I've always been interested in it. What got me into actually investigating was I was 10 years old, and there was a Disney Adventures magazine. I don't know if you guys remember it or not, but there was an article in there on real life Ghostbusters and Troy Taylor. And I remember reading it and thinking, oh my God, people actually do this, at least somewhat for a living. And that kind of started me down the road of watching paranormal shows and just getting into the investigative side. And eventually when I was 16, for Christmas, I got my first ghost hunting kit, same year that I got my first car, and just got into it.
Cool. When you look back on the moments of the woman standing over your crib and your mom telling you that story, I mean, what was going through your mom's mind at that time? If she saw something standing over her child's crib, I mean, that's kind of a disturbing thing to experience as a parent.
My mom was always super religious. She had called it an angel once or twice. She never really got into how she felt, other than saying that it was kind of a comfort. But my family doesn't talk about the paranormal that much.
Even though they've had those experiences firsthand, it's interesting where that kind of dynamic comes into place, where it's like you have them, but we're not going to talk about it. Tell me about what you felt when you can remember actually seeing this figure. Obviously, you know, you're probably a little bit older than just being in the crib.
Yeah, so I was. It would have been after I started school, so it would have been after 5 years old. But I was absolutely terrified. And I didn't know what to make of it. I didn't know what to think of it. I was actually a pretty timid kid, so I was scared of my own shadow. There were a lot of things that went on in my childhood that I don't really talk about. But I was a pretty scared kid. And when I found out about ghost hunting, and when I found out about people actually going out and investigating these things, and I actually started reading more, my middle school library had a huge occult section in the library. So the more I learned about it, the more comfortable I got, and the more I realized that it's not really something to be scared of most of the time.
Did you have other experiences with the paranormal beyond the woman in the house that terrified you because you didn't know what she was?
When I was a kid, like before I actually started going out and doing investigations, mm-hmm. I didn't.
Okay.
It wasn't something that I actively looked for. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that I think is as common as most people make it out to be.
Why is that?
There were things when I was younger and when I was a kid that frightened me. But when I went back with more training and more experience as an investigator, and I really looked into those, most of those situations I was able to say were okay. This was my imagination running away with me. This was a bunch of kids standing in the woods that freaked each other out. We didn't actually see anything.
Mm-hmm. When you look back on this, I'm sure you have some curiosity as to the identity of what this woman is, or who she is or was, or whatever it is. What, you know, what have you found there when you kind of look back on that? Have you done any sort of digging into trying to find the answer to that?
I've tried to do a little bit of digging, but I haven't found anything that's attached to the property. And the house was moved from another location, and I don't know the exact location of where it came from, so I haven't been able to dig into those specific records. Going back through newspaper clippings and going back through different articles and police reports that I'm able to look at, I haven't found anything that matches up to the woman that I've seen. I was about ready to chalk it up to just being my imagination until my mom opened up about it and my brother opened up about it. I was visiting him, let's see, it would have been 2014, and I came out. He was sleeping on the couch, and he would never talk about why he was on the couch. Mm-hmm. And then I started thinking back, and I was like, well, mom slept on the couch a lot too. Doing investigations, I found that people that are disturbed by the activity in their homes, they often don't sleep in their bedrooms. They sleep on the sofas in the living room. And I still haven't figured out why that holds and that's consistent for hauntings. Mm-hmm. But he was on the couch. So I spent the night in my old room. I woke up in the middle of the night and I saw her standing there again. Now, this would have been in my mid-20s, I guess, mm-hmm. about 2014. So I got up. I kept my eyes open. So I wake up and this woman's standing there. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to just stare. I'm not going to blink, because if I blink and close my eyes, I'm going to open them and she's going to be gone and it's going to freak me out. And after a while, she just kind of faded away, which was so much worse than just blinking and her not being there. Mm-hmm. So I got up out of bed. I went to the living room. My brother walks down from the upstairs and I'm sitting on the couch and he just looks at me and he goes, huh, dead chick in the closet. I kind of looked at him and was like, yeah, you've seen her. And he went into the fridge, got a couple beers, and we sat on the couch and had a drink. And I found out that a lot of his friends and the people that came over that stayed in that house, many of them would refuse to come back because they all had some kind of run-in or some kind of weird thing that happened that just made them uneasy about the place.
How did that make you feel to kind of get confirmation from your brother that you weren't alone in having those experiences?
Oh, it felt great. The validation, everybody, it doesn't matter if you've accepted this as being something that's real and something that is worth looking into. If you've had any kind of experience, it always feels great to hear it from somebody else, mm-hmm. especially when you haven't opened up to them yourself.
Sure. So you have these experiences as a child, you know that there's something else going on here. I mean, you're trying to make sense of it. Sometimes you're chalking it up to imagination. Sometimes you're on the path of, no, this is certainly something paranormal. And once you get more and more proof of this and validation from others, you really kind of have the confirmation that, yes, you had these experiences. Tell me then how this kind of progresses into the world of paranormal investigation. I know you said you got your first ghost hunting kit at the age of 16. At the same time, you're able to drive and kind of go in and see what's out there. How did that path begin for you then, once you had those tools in your chest?
Well, I went to a vocational high school where we were able to pick a dual path where we could study and knock out some college courses, and we could kind of play around with the area of or the career that we wanted to go into. And I was a criminal justice student, and I loved investigations, specifically forensics and evidence collection and evidence analysis. So I was way, way too young to actually do that professional with any sort of police department or even any sort of private company. So I looked at investigations, and I looked at the way that ghost hunting was done. I looked at the way that we interview people, the way that we collect evidence, and how we draw conclusions, and thought, this is something I'm interested in, and it's something that gives me actual experience using the same skills that I'm going to use in my career. Mm-hmm. So I started going around, and I started looking at local legends, local hauntings, cemeteries that had some sort of reputation for being haunted. And that's how I learned how to dig through public records. That's how I learned how to effectively interview people before I actually got in the field as a professional investigator.
So tell me about that. I mean, tell me then, as you kind of got into the field as a professional investigator, what were some of those specific things that really kind of carried over that you learned that you found helpful that maybe you saw others were not necessarily doing?
Well, investigations, it doesn't matter if you're looking to a homicide, a divorce, a ghost, or a cryptid, the act of investigating is the same. It's the elements that change. Mm-hmm. So something that that really helped me was the interviewing skills, talking to people, getting them to open up and trust me. I'm a licensed private investigator. I'm not a police officer, so I don't have the authority to force people to talk to me. When I get a statement or when I get something from someone, it's because they want to talk to me, and it's because they trust me and they feel comfortable around me. That's probably one of the biggest carryovers from ghost hunting in the paranormal, because it is so hard sometimes to get property owners and past residents to open up about things that happened to them. Mm-hmm. So that has been a huge help as an investigator, just getting people to talk to me.
So tell me about that. As you began to get into the world of investigating the paranormal, how did that begin? I mean, a lot of people, they'll watch TV shows and think, oh, you just jump right in and boom, 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 you're getting stuff left and right. How did that work for you?
It's slow. You don't get things every time you go out. And like I said, I don't think every location is haunted. When I started, there weren't a whole lot of TV shows. There was, let's see, this would have been about 2001. So I think there was World's Scariest Places, and most of the stuff was books and magazine articles, mm-hmm. and different things that you would find on old chat rooms. I don't even know if those are still a thing. But, yeah.
And half the audience is like, what's a chat room?
Right. So I would go out and I would make mistakes. I know I was, I tried hostile provoking where you're goading entities into performing for you, basically. And I think I went through the evolution that a lot of ghost hunters and a lot of paranormal investigators go through, where you go out and you do things that are honestly pretty stupid to try to elicit and get evidence. Mm-hmm. And it's more about getting evidence to validate your beliefs and to validate that this is actually worth looking into. And then also to have something cool to show people. Mm-hmm. After a couple of years of doing that, I realized these things, whether they're the spirits of the dead or they're thought forms that have developed personality, and they're beings, and they have emotions. They try to communicate with us, and I shouldn't just be going out here and hitting these places up and basically just disrupting their day and calling them out and forcing them to. Trying to force them to perform on cue. And that's where I got a little bit more direction. And I thought, well, if I'll concentrate on people and their homes, people that feel uncomfortable that are having these types of hauntings, and I'll go in and I'll try to explain what I can and then help them to deal with the haunting, whether that's hooking them up with someone that can do a blessing in their faith, teaching them different ways to live with the activity, and basically just helping people understand. So I went from it being all about me getting evidence to helping people understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm. I mean, tell me about that evolution a little bit more. I mean, you see that sometimes on some television shows, and I've talked to, you know, some people who think that being hostile towards the entities is like the way to go. I'm not saying that I believe that, but you have a lot of people who kind of get passionate about that, and it's like provoking and goading them into acting. And it's like, is that, I mean, a lot of times you kind of got to look at it as these, in many cases, were people once too. If you start insulting, screaming, and provoking someone in real life, you're not going to get a very good conversation out of that. You're not going to get the true personality of the person coming out. You're going to get, you know, the aggravated, you know, kind of defensive version of that going on. What did you find when you were doing that? I mean, did you in fact get evidence by doing those things at first, you know, just out of not knowing any better at the moment? Or, you know, how did that evolve for you?
I did get some good evidence out of it, and I got some interesting experiences from it, but they were all negative. I think it's kind of like people. People have different personalities. They have different triggers. They have different limits. Sometimes you can walk up to somebody and scream at them, and they're, I'm going to say, a more enlightened person, and they're going to kind of turn their, not turn their back, but they're going to walk away and just kind of ignore it. And then you do that same thing to another person, and they're going to punch you in the face.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same. I've noticed that it's the same thing in the spirit world or in hauntings. Sometimes you go in and you provoke and you start doing these things, and they're just like, well, this is what you want me to do, so I'm not going to do it. Or you go in and you really tick them off. And the last time that I did a hostile provoking was probably one of the worst manifestations that I witnessed as an investigator. I was in a home. They had talked about shadow people, and they had talked about different manifestations that were supposedly darker, or they had interpreted as being pretty dark. We couldn't get any information. We couldn't get any activity while we were there. So last ditch effort, I started doing hostile provoking, calling them out, cursing, saying I didn't believe in them. And a lamp swung over and broke, picture frames flung off the wall in my direction. And that was the one time that I was ran out of a house. And that was the last time that I did specifically that type of provoking, because it did cause the haunting to get worse for the homeowners.
What was
and
the,
that's,
go ahead.
Go ahead. So that's one of the reasons that I stopped, because I realized these things do have feelings, and it's not only about the emotional state of the entities that we're interacting with, if that's what it is. It's also about the people that have to live in those properties and the people that have to be there after I leave.
And my question is, what was the reaction of the homeowner after that incident?
Well, they weren't happy.
I can gather that.
Yeah. It took a little bit to get things to calm down. I didn't go back to that property. I stayed in contact with the homeowner,
mm-hmm.
and things eventually died down. There were some tornadoes that came through that region. I don't even remember the year that the tornado hit, but that house ended up being completely destroyed.
Oh, wow.
And they ended up moving. So
nature took care of it.
Yeah. Nature took care of that one. But as investigators, everybody's going to mess up. Everybody's going to do things that in the time period that they are doing them, it is an acceptable practice.
Mm-hmm.
But as we learn more and as fields evolve, we realize that there are some things that are just wrong that we should not have done.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, situations like that are, it's how we learn it.
Well, at that point in time, what was your goal going in as an investigator? Was it simply to prove, and give another, documentation, another, voice to say, yes, your house is haunted? Was your goal to, at that moment in time, try and eradicate the thing? What was your thought process going in when that was, your approach?
My goal, I had two specific goals with that particular case. One, my overall goal was to gather as much evidence as possible, to have as much physical evidence to present as possible. And then also to find out if the entity was in fact a danger to the family, or if it was there just to cause problems and disruption.
Mm-hmm. With something like that, when you have something that does, it's flipping lamps, it's picture frames are flying off the walls, a lot of people will look at that and go, that's evil, that's demonic, and the word that gets thrown around all too much. What do you believe was going on in that house? Do you think it was something really dark, or do you think it just pissed off a person that was dead?
At the time, I took it as possibly being something dark.
Mm-hmm.
We had a manifestation of the thing. It showed itself in the hallway while we were doing the provoking. It was just kind of a dark three-dimensional shadow.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the buzzword was shadow people, and shadow people are negative entities.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that as it being negative. Look back on it and knowing the things that I know now from interactions that we've had, and not just interacting with ghosts, but interacting with people and things with personalities. I think I just ticked somebody off.
Yeah.
Because if it was truly a dark or an evil being, I don't think those frames would have missed me.
What do you think of a case like that where you had the experience? It's obviously a very active place where it's able to do things like that. But then, as you said, a tornado ended up taking out the house. When something like that happens and the property is destroyed, whether it be through a tornado, whether it be through a wrecking ball by somebody just tearing down the property, where do entities go after that? It's just an opinion-based question. Do they continue to linger on that land, on that property, or do they move on? Or what do you think happens in cases like that?
So this would just be complete speculation.
Sure.
I think it depends on the type of entity it is. Mm-hmm. As investigators and in science in general, people like to put things in boxes. We like to look at a home that has objects disappearing, reappearing, and objects moving across tables or people seeing apparitions. And we want to put that into a box. We either want to say that it's all poltergeist activity or all some sort of human agent, pent up psychic phenomenon, mm-hmm. or that it's the spirits of the dead or some sort of spiritual manifestation that's trying to communicate. I think with a lot of this, there's a lot more going on than this or that.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are different types of manifestations, different types of entities, and whether it's going to stay there at that location, it's going to depend on what type it is. Say it's a human haunting where the person was just really attached to that home. They had spent their life there. They loved it. And maybe they weren't super thrilled about people living there and moving into the place.
Mm-hmm.
That entity might very well stay on that property because they're attached to that land. And I don't know if time or what happens to physical locations matters on that side of things. The house could be completely destroyed, but a spiritual being who is not living in our world could still be there in some sort of spiritual construct.
Mm-hmm. Tell me more about, as you continued on as an investigator and developing new tactics to try and communicate, tell me about some of those stories and as things evolved for you.
So we started out, and I've never been big on using mediums and psychics as actual evidence to present during a haunting. When it comes to spirit communication, we've tried rapping, where we try to get them to knock once for yes, knock twice for no. Most of the spiritual communication that I've done has been through EVPs. It's been one of my favorite ways to communicate because it is a direct way to communicate,
mm-hmm.
where we do a quick 5-minute session asking questions, giving 30 seconds for it to answer, and then playing back to see if we get any kind of an answer.
Mm-hmm.
Class A EVPs are super rare where you're actually able to hear what they're saying. Class B to C are a lot more common, but they do require some kind of editing after the fact, you know, speed them up, enhance them to get out a little bit more information or try to figure out what they're saying. But when you start manipulating the EVPs and you start especially messing with the cadence of the speech, you can actually change the words being said or the phonics.
Mm-hmm.
So EVPs have absolutely been my favorites. Now I will work with psychics and mediums occasionally. I don't present that as evidence, but I do use it to help me know what questions to ask for EVP sessions. Or when I'm looking for records and I'm trying to identify what might have happened on the property, what might have happened with an item in the house or try to get to where a haunting came from, if there's any reason for it, I will use psychics for that. And recently I've gotten into ghost box communication. I know it's been around for a long time. I've been super slow to get into it because it just seemed kind of trendy.
Mm-hmm.
kind of niche. I have had some interesting experiences with spirit boxes. So I try to stay away from the more hokey aspects, the more metaphysical aspects of ghost hunting. I've always been more about the physical approach to it.
Mm-hmm.
More recently, though, especially with what we've been doing with spirit boxes, I've noticed there is some metaphysical aspect to it with ghost box communication. I specifically got one type of ghost box. I did an experiment with it, just trying to look and see what the different speeds were, if the clicks, the pops, the different sound fragments that were coming through, the cadence, could it manifest in physical words, or is this pareidolia where we're just kind of hearing what we want to hear? And when I had it on once, I live in a property that is absolutely not haunted, never had any sort of paranormal activity at all.
Mm-hmm.
I turned the box on and I'm just kind of testing it, looking at it, not actually doing a spirit box session. And when I turn the box off, I get ready, I go to bed later that night. I wake up probably about 1 o'clock in the morning and I just kind of sit up in bed and I'm wide awake. I'm looking around and I notice there's someone standing in the closet. And it's the outline of a female. And I'm like, what's going on? And I start looking around. I'm like, okay, maybe I'm asleep. Maybe I'm dreaming. My girlfriend, Kristen, wakes up and she's like, what's going on? It's nothing. Just go back to sleep. A little bit of backstory. Kristen told me to never turn that thing on in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And not to do any sort of communication or any sort of research or anything in the house. So I kind of broke that rule when I turned it on. And for the next couple of days, we had things going missing around the house. I'd walk into a room to get my keys, or Kristen would go to get her keys, and they weren't in the bowl at the front of the house where we usually keep them. And we'd just kind of find them in weird places. The next time that I was messing with the box, I had turned it on to kind of do the same thing again. And it was on for maybe about 15 minutes, and I turned it off. And that was the last time that we had any sort of activity in the house. So that's when I started really digging more into the metaphysical side of ghost boxes and the theories on how they worked, about how they use your psychic and spiritual energy to make a connection with the other side. And they actually open a doorway, allowing things to move in and out of conversations, in and out of our worlds. And I had never given that side of spirit boxes or that side of using the equipment much thought until that happened.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, that'll you know, put a little, you know, pause on, you know, your thought process on it as far as having those experiences after you use it. What to you, it's an opinion-based question, with a spirit box, is there a difference between using a spirit box to try and get words and answers between that and like using a Ouija board?
I don't think so. But before I had that particular experience, I would have said yes. Mm-hmm. It's more like doing EVPs or doing using a digital voice recorder. You're communicating with a spirit that is there, that's able to physically manipulate the device. But after having that specific experience, yeah, I think the person using the device is opening a channel to communicate, mm-hmm. Similar to a Ouija board or some of the older ways that people used to do seances.
Yeah. So when you use a spirit box, and I'm trying to understand it myself a little bit, I just recently started to get some equipment here. And for years, you know, the last 10 years of doing these shows, I'm not an investigator. I never have been. I just talk to them. But starting to think about doing maybe a little more branching outside of the studio. So I've gotten some equipment here and there, and I do not turn that thing on in my house. My office is a separate structure, and the studio is a separate structure from the house. But I have turned it on here in the studio, and I have recently also gotten a REM pod. And I was messing around with the spirit box out here. And again, never had anything haunted or ghostly going on in this house. It's a fairly new property, all that. There's not a lot of history either. It was basically a cattle field. So I felt like okay about it. But when I was messing around with it recently in the office, I do get some words here and there that I mean, having worked in radio 20 some years, I can tell the difference between a broadcast voice and something that's not being broadcast, and I can hear it, and I can like, what the hell was that? And it doesn't always necessarily make a lot of sense to what I'm talking about, but I know it's not a signal from a radio station. But I did have the two kind of coincide with one another, where the REM pod's on the other side of the studio and the ghost box is going, and it kind of freaked me out, where I got a brief word coming through and then boom, on the other side of the room, the REM pod, you know, goes off. And it kind of gave me a little bit of pause of like, what the hell is going on here? Not that I don't believe these things can happen, but I was like, is something, are things being invited in when you do that? Is there some danger with using a ghost box, you know, when you're not necessarily on an investigation where somebody, you're trying to find answers, you're just literally sitting at your house going, let's see if this works.
I think there's danger in any part of the unknown.
Yeah.
We're basically opening a doorway or doing a beacon. The people that design these boxes, that they know a bit, but no one knows exactly how the equipment works or why it's being manipulated the way that it is. Mm-hmm. So there's always a bit of danger. There's always the possibility that we're not communicating with the dead or spirits as we know them at all. That the other side or whatever we're communicating with is just something that's bored.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, whenever you open a doorway, whenever you ask a question, there's always a possibility that you're not going to like the answer. And going back to what you said about how you felt when you got that first communication where you can't explain it away other than anything in another way. Other than saying that something was trying to communicate with you, that's something that all investigators experience at some point if they stay in long enough to actually get a solid communication or get touched.
Mm-hmm.
My very first spirit communication was an EVP that said my name. We were in a home where we knew the property owner had died. We were able to pull the records, pull the obituaries, and match up the story to the local legend of how that guy died. He's a very possessive person, and in that specific bedroom, he didn't like people being there.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the night at the home alone in that bedroom, in that bed, with a recorder running. And the EVP that we got said my name. It's this really creepy tenor, and then a little bit later, it just tells me to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first actual class A 100%. That was an EVP. I was alone in that house and I didn't say that. So when I was listening to that, when I was going through and listening to the recording, I had headphones on and I was sitting in my room, and I threw the headphones off of my head and just kind of sat there for a minute and then walked over, picked him up and listened to it a couple more times.
Mm-hmm.
The first time you get an EVP, the first time you get any sort of spirit communication, it always messes with you a bit.
Sure. That wraps up part one of our conversation with Tanner Rutledge. In part two, is it possible for thought forms to develop a personality? Can the living destroy a negative thought form or entity that they created? Why are some EVPs noticeably clear when they come through and others very convoluted? Is there a way to give entities more strength to communicate and come through? Until next time for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Brisky. Thanks for listening.